Icebox is bad. Eat the rich. Show your stomach you can. Eat the rich. Pull the rich out of the power. I think it's a shame. Swear they're not the problem, but we know.
Welcome to Subversity here, another edition of this interview program here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Today we have with us in the studio Paul Gilroy, who's a cultural critic born in England and now teaching at Yale. With us also is Professor Glenn Mimura from the Asian American Studies program. Who will join in our discussion. I just came back from a diaspora conference, and you've written that is it correct to say it's more important where you're at than where you're from?
Yes, I think that I've tried to suggest that we get bound up too much with the problem of origins, and that our fate, more of our destiny is on our own hands than we often like to conceive. That we have a greater power, even under the most restricted and dangerous boxed-in circumstances, we tend to have a greater opportunity to shape our own futures than we like to concede. And I think that turning away from the problem of origins, which is a kind of modernist, a sort of 19th century problem, into a different relationship to our own future in our own hands is something I want to promote.
It's like people ask why are people gay, instead of, you know, accepting it.
Well, or just thinking, well, okay, so you're gay. What are you going to do with it? You know, anything? I mean, I don't believe that those fixed notions of identity carry with them any guaranteed political possibility. You know, we're just looking in Europe very much at the experience of the people of the Netherlands who are facing the political crisis that has been prompted by the assassination of Pim Fortuyn, an out gay man leader, a charismatic political figure, but a charismatic political figure of the libertarian right. Now, you know, for me this is an important reminder that being an out gay man doesn't carry with it any necessary political effects. There's no political experience that corresponds to that struggle to be an out gay man, even in a rather more tolerant environment like the one that the Netherlands. Here's somebody who can combine a libertarian position on the question of sexuality with a kind of proto-fascist hatred of otherness and a hyper-nationalistic defensiveness about immigrants and refugees, and of course fundamentally with a kind of Islamophobic position, which looks at Islam as a uniquely backward and destructive spiritual formation in the world. So I think, you know, we have to really loosen up our sense of where these lines between left and right are beginning to fall. We're in a situation which is very fluid and where those lines are being blurred all the time.
Do you think there is a queer diaspora? Because the editor of Diaspora spoke at that conference also, and he was saying that he had turned down an article suggesting that, and yet there's a book from Duke with the same title. And I talked to him later, and he said he didn't think there was it was possible, because the way he defines diaspora is a community that is organized to kind of reflect on the homeland, to keep the ties going. Whereas he was saying that even there's no Italian diaspora, because there's no, he claims there's no kind of regular contact between people here, or that they don't think of the homeland in an organized way, like some in, say, a Chinese diaspora maybe.
Well, I suppose I'd like to, at the moment I feel I want to try and work with a more restricted understanding of what diaspora represents as an analytical and political possibility. I think that for me it's most useful where it's closest to violence and terror, where it's most useful where this movement is not necessarily a freely chosen or voluntary act, but something that is a result of being forced to move. And I think it's essential to not to romanticize displacement. So on the question of a queer diaspora. I'm not sure that I agree with him in the sense that I don't feel that a physical territory, a sort of sovereign territory, a place of origin in spatial terms is necessarily the deciding factor. It may well be that forced flight from terror directed towards you because of your sexuality might well lead you to constitute a web of connection, of belonging, of transmodern association, which could have affinities with the diaspora, might identify itself in that way. I'd certainly want to be open to that possibility.
Arif Derlik was there also, and he's Turkish, but he's sympathetic with the Armenians, and he mentioned the genocide by the Turks against the Armenians, and he said it would be obscene to call Turks a diasporic group, because they were responsible for the forced diaspora of Armenians.
What about Cyprus? You know, I mean, people, the Turkish people in Cyprus have suffered those sorts of experiences. I mean, not to the same genocidal extent, of course, but have suffered some of the same pressures at the hands of the Greek Cypriots. So, I mean, I don't think that having suffered in one episode, in one historical event, renders you immune to the lure, to the possibility of inflicting that suffering on other people. In fact, it might actually be the opposite. It might make it much more likely that you would be inclined to those sorts of anti-political shortcuts and militaristic fantasies, if you yourself have suffered so brutally at that the hands of that.
What do you think of the? I heard that you mentioned. I wasn't able to go to your lectures, but I heard that you mentioned the Guantanamo Bay and prisoners there. A camp, so-called X-ray.
Should we call it that? I don't know.
What do you think of the way the administration is portraying them?
Well, I tried in my lecture to suggest that the production of these shackled, humiliated, and despised orange-suited bodies, you know, being fed their culturally appropriate meals by your government, was something that was continuous with the elaboration of what I want to call a kind of colonial moral economy, a distinctive mode of governance that produces this sort of abjected body of the native, you know, as a form of infrahuman life, something less than a human being, maybe even, you know, less than an animal, to the extent that animals are usually benefits of a kind of a mentality which looks to them as pets. You know, they need to be kind of cared for, and this kind of infrahuman life form is something which is outside of that sort of generosity.
You also were quoted in one of these in a bibliography a colleague of mine, Eddie Yagayan, put out, and he quotes you from an article by Laura Chrisman in a book on an issue of a paragraph in 1993. It says it's about your view of ethnicity, and you say we must be aware of the use of ethnicity to wrap a spurious cloak of legitimacy around the speaker who invokes it. Culture, even the culture which defines the groups we know as races, is never fixed, finished, or final. Do you think in this focus on, you know, study of diasporas, people kind of tend to essentialize the homeland?
Well, yeah, they either essentialize the homeland or they essentialize the destination, you know. And actually, for me, what's important about the diasporic paradigm, if it is one, is that we are in between, and we want to keep that. We want to preserve that tension and work with that tension. We don't want to be assimilated, and we don't want to be autochthonized, you know. We want to find, we want to explore. I mean, a good example, which is, of course, very much connected to the experience of what's going on in the Middle East right now, is the position that, you know, Primo Levi took in 1982 when the invasion of Lebanon was on. And there was, in a sense, a sort of historic antecedent to the situation that we're in now. Once again, Ariel Sharon, you know, who I personally believe to be a war criminal, was engaged in a range of political, military and political adventures in Lebanon that culminated in the death of numerous people. And at that time, Levi, alarmed, and, you know, remember here, Levy carries with him, although he systematically undermined it, the moral authority of a survivor of Auschwitz. And he said at that point that it was wrong, he felt, for the state of Israel itself to become the guardian and the disciplinary authority around the life of Jewish identity. He felt that in response to that violation of human rights and that episode of terror, that it might be possible to imagine that diasporic Jewry held the custodianship of Jewish identity. And I think that there's something in that lesson, in that moral and political response to the pathological workings of nation states. I'm not singling the Israelis out in particular here, because I think that this is inscribed in the modes of governance that national states practice, these dangers. But Levy was very, very powerful, very acute, very eloquent in saying that diasporic Jews could become the custodians of Jewish identity.
Yeah, this is Glenn Memora, Asian American Studies professor, interviewing Paul Gilroy with Dan Song. I just wanted to backtrack a little bit and maybe ask you to explain, what do you mean by race? And how do you think, and you know, in particular, how does it depart from or sort of engage with a more popular understanding of race, you know, here in the United States today?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I don't mean by race are the sort of visual signs and cues coded in on and around the body. I think what I'm trying to do when I invoke the concept of race is to look at the political, governmental, and juridical ordering of systems of racial hierarchy in the world. In other words, when I talk about race, I'm talking about what you, within the American vocabulary, would call racism. But here, you know, there's a real linguistic problem about the way that the terms race and racism function against each other, which I'm still negotiating with difficulty, in fact. It seems to me here people love to talk about race, nothing more. That they like, they enjoy, they relish talking about race, but they're not so keen to talk about racism. And I think, in a sense, my intervention has suffered by my inability to translate it into some of the local script around that.
The South Africans used to call it, the Afrikaans used to call it racialism.
Yes, they tried to distinguish it. I felt that was very clumsy, and what I tried to do in my book was to offer a different sort of conceptual system for making sense of this. But I mean, you know, probably that hasn't worked very well. What else comes out of the South African history, which is really important to us, was a sense of what they call not racialism, but of non-racialism. They said that if the government gave you a book, a little pass that you carried around that told you what your race was, if that system, that hierarchy, was so heavily invested in a racial hierarchy, if you were going to turn over that system, if you were going to change that system, you couldn't retain that category. You had to change it. And I guess I was very influenced by that.
Mm-hmm. I guess just as a follow-up, you know, in the wake of your most recent book, Against Race, or published in the United States under the title Against Race, and published in England under the title Between Camps, is that right? In the wake of its publication, a number of people, and also in response to your talks over the past few days, there have been a number of people who have been quite annoyed, I think, by your argument against race, which they take to mean forgetting race. Yet I think that your work since your first book, There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack, you've insisted on the importance of any kind of quote-unquote alternative humanism or cosmopolitanism to account for, to negotiate and engage, to reckon with the memory of slavery and racial violence that constituted modernity, right? So, I mean, I see an interesting disconnect in terms of how your work is being read right now, mm-hmm. where it's being read as saying, your gesture to say we need to move beyond race is being taken as a statement that we should forget race. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think you might be right, and I feel, you know, terribly upset about that, although, you know, I don't think that there's anything in my book that supports that reading, and it's troubling doubly because I think that people, you know, don't always read. You know, I think there's something about the title of the book which provokes that kind of reaction, and that's kind of tragic, really, in institutions of learning, you know, where at least, you know, the practice of close reading was always an integral way of learning and of teaching. So that's one thing. But I think there are some deeper reasons about that. You know, I mean, I'm certainly not saying forget race. I'm simply saying that what we might do is turn away from what looks like the shortcuts into solidarity that we imagine race provides for us. I'm saying, in the spirit of where I started in our conversation, that our sense of making racial solidarity is something we have to do. It's a political problem, and it's in our hands. There's nothing coded in my mitochondrial DNA, you know, which predisposes me to fraternity with people who I imagine are like myself. I wish that was the case, actually, because it would make the sorts of things that we have to do to resist racism in government, in education, in healthcare, you know, globally, would make those things a whole lot easier if we could kick in some bio shortcut or some cultural shortcut, you know. But those things don't exist, and, you know, our investment in the idea that those shortcuts are there is a measure of our weakness, really, rather than an indication of our strength and our imagination.
So you're not on the same side as Ward Connolly, who's trying to say, don't collect data on race.
No, I think Ward Connolly is someone I would regard as very much on the other side. I think that when we've dealt with racism, then we can get to the Ward Connolly position. At the moment, I don't see Ward Connolly dealing with racism, actually. I think that the device of disconnecting from race in his version of it is a way of trying to pretend that racism doesn't structure the world. I think, you know, I'd want to look at it in quite the opposite way around.
You know, this idea of solidarity among people of color, I was just looking back at the 60s when Asian American studies and the movement for to identify as Asian American, for instance, started, and there seemed to be a lot more alliance building than with other groups, whereas now it seems like people are more into their own ethnic groups and doing stuff, except maybe since 9/11, maybe that because of hate crimes, there's maybe a little bit more identification with, say, South Asians at this point, at least for Asian Americans. Do you think, how do people build solidarity then?
Well, I think that that's a political question. I think that before we get to it, we have to understand why they turn away from politics and instead seek a kind of almost like therapeutic relationship with people that they imagine to be like themselves, and what sorts of comfort, what needs does that desire, you know, answer? What is it about being with people that you think are like yourself? I mean, what is it? Maybe there's something, I mean, might be too simple, but for me, you know, I'd want to understand that desire as something that was a response to the forms of racism that people encounter very often. They imagine that rather than act politically against that impact on their lives, they can sort of, well, I won't say anesthetize, but comfort each other by being together. And those things aren't always easy to turn back into a political gesture. So I think we have to first of all begin a kind of critical commentary on the desire to heal oneself or help oneself collectively by simply being together, because I think that doesn't solve the problem of being on the receiving end of hatred and inequality. So I think we have to do that first before we can begin to say, well, how might we begin to build a different kind of solidarity? I mean, there are lots of things that are happening in the world. There are lots of things that are happening in this country since last September and the terrorist attacks there, which actually invite the new varieties of solidarity into being. You know, one obvious thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately is the way that the struggle against AIDS and HIV as a worldwide phenomenon promotes a different set of possible solidarities, a different network of political innovations and actions against the power of drug companies and so on, you know, which demands a kind of global strategy, a planetary orientation. Now, if you're too busy, you know, healing yourself by being with people who are like you, you can miss the sort of, I don't know what it would be, the sort of alternative conception of human vulnerability. The sense of a suffering humanity, which is unlocked by facing the fact that any one of us can experience AIDS and HIV. All of us are vulnerable to that.
So you say we need to make a political choice instead of just seeking comfort among people of the same kind, say?
I think the moment of corporate multiculturalism, which is the moment we're in, offers you the chance to celebrate your particularity as an alternative to that political engagement. It offers you the chance to go celebrate your ethnicity, your culture, your particularity, your locality, your language as an alternative. Now, I don't believe people shouldn't celebrate. I think they should celebrate, but I think that there are ways, other ways of organizing the relationship between the celebration, moment of celebration, and the moment of political engagement.
But in England, this whole focus on multiculturalism, I guess in Canada there's more of a kind of structured focus.
Yes. Yes.
It's breaking down in England, right?
Well, it is and it isn't breaking down. It's breaking down in England because the government doesn't offer political leadership in this area. That's why it's breaking down. I mean, in terms of, if you look at the poll data in England, there's a very hardcore minority of older white people, very often in rural areas, who don't like the idea that their sense of England is being changed under their noses. But the majority of people, and this isn't just a split between London and the rest of the country, the majority of people are not only comfortable with the idea that the country has changed, but they also, in a sort of tentative and interesting way, look to the elaboration of diversity, of cultural diversity, as something which is a civic asset. And I think that that's where the problem of political leadership is seen to be failing.
Okay, again, we're speaking with Paul Gilroy on KUCI, with Dan Song and Glenn Memora. I actually, just raising the issue of England, and U.S. popular cultures. Your earlier works, "There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack," "Small Axe," thoughts on the politics of black cultures, and "The Black Atlantic," dual modernity and dual consciousness, have a lot of the more hopeful aspects of those books, or the more hopeful dimensions of cultural politics and politics at large, derive in your work from sources in popular culture. How would you assess, in some sense, the state of popular cultures today?
Well, I think the change in tone, you know, in my work, really results from I won't say despair, because I don't despair, but I think that the sorts of utopian and oppositional textures that nurtured me, which nourished me, I find them harder to locate. And this isn't just a question of aging, you know. I think it's really a question of globalization of cultures, and the globalization in particular, the changed forms of African-American culture, of American culture, which are in circulation in this moment of the instantiation of the American Empire, you know. So it's very difficult to maintain or to invest that, you know, to discover that utopian, that redemptive moment in those things, when it's clear that these what were oppositional forms of culture have been mainstreamed as a sort of soundtrack and the dreamscape for selling American cultures worldwide. So it's very hard for me to see or to manage the tension which comes from, on the one hand, these historic resources, these traditional means of expression, which are supportive and nurturing for people. At the same time, they're being pimped by corporate multiculture worldwide, and that's something that people have to engage with. And you know, I mean, the best example of all of this is the fate of hip-hop, which, you know, of course, is still alive locally in all sorts of diverse and exciting scenes, different language groups and language games regionally and locally, but at the same time is also, you know, absolutely emptied of anything interesting as a sort of routine element in, you know, the sort of transaction of a whole range of ghastly consumerist things. And so, you know, I think that there's no point just being a cheerleader at that point. You have to really try and, again, make some uncomfortable sort of political judgments about what the things are you want to defend, and to give up the idea that there's anything automatic. You know, we're mature enough, we're old enough now to be able to say, well, just because it's a black person making some money off it doesn't mean there's something we have to support.
Okay. Yeah, I just as a kind of follow-up question that explores a little bit of your own intellectual biography. I mean, one of the issues that I don't think was actually touched on by David Goldberg or James Ferguson in their introductions for your two respective talks was also the importance of the Black Arts Movement in your sort of intellectual formation. It sort of dovetailed, I guess, with the latter years of the Birmingham Cultural Studies School, and was really a very dynamic period of you know, sort of dynamic point in British, contemporary British history. When you look back on that period, you know, how would you describe it? I mean, did you see it as a kind of compromise on the part of, you know, the nation and the state? Did you see it, or was it something that had a lasting transformative effect, or, you know, how would you describe that period?
Well, I think it is something that's had a transformative effect. It's helped, I mean, and this was actually not something that was anticipated by the practitioners, you know, in many fields, literature, art, film. It's something which has impacted in a very powerful way on the way in which the country understands itself and its position in the world. And I don't know how long that will endure, but I don't, you know, a moment ago I cited the kind of poll numbers which are saying that so many people are comfortable with the idea of a more diverse and more plural understanding of the nation, and that for them the issue of being black or being brown or being British is just not a problem. And I think without that concerted intervention by that movement, which I think is kind of dispersed, really, and these things are hard to sustain anyway, hasn't reproduced itself very much over time. Without that moment, that intense moment of struggle, that outcome wouldn't have been possible.
You know, I grew up in Hong Kong, and I recently wrote that I learned about, for instance, about gay literature, reading the books of the imperialists, and was able to kind of liberate myself. Do you think that's a common kind of phenomenon for people of color living in colonies to kind of to take back, I guess?
I do. I think that's a routine effect of colonial education. And it's a very ambivalent one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I know that the literature, the moment of the national liberation phase, you know, was that we had to decolonize our minds, you know, and that involved, you know, a very often a kind of ruthless and systematic distancing from the center of that colonial project in the field of education. But there are always unintended effects. There are always other possibilities, other encounters, you know. You know, obviously my mother was a migrant from the Caribbean. You know, I mean, watching that generation to which she belonged, you know, seeing where their sense of themselves as an anti-colonial generation was enriched by their relationship to a sense of English culture, which was an oppositional one. You know, which was the oppositional England of the Romantics, you know, the oppositional England of Blake, of Shelley, you know, of the poems of 1819, you know. Of course, look at C.L.R. James, you know, as another sort of sometimes rather difficult emblem of the way in which those unanticipated borrowings fold over and feed back into an oppositional culture. You know, I think these are the routine features of a colonial system. Frantz Fanon, you know, another beneficiary of that sort of elite education of the colonizing power, someone who fled back to Europe to fight in the war against the Nazis because he felt that that human freedom was at stake there, and was then, you know, whose life then was transformed by the desire to transform the moral and political standards which were operative in the struggle against fascism into the world of national liberation in the service of Algeria. So I think these are routine effects, and I think, you know, perhaps, you know, Edward Said is somebody who's you know, very loyal to the to a sort of narrow aesthetic understanding of what constitutes the greatness of those texts and the literary and cultural projects of which they're part. But I think he has been our best and richest guide to the ambivalence involved in that relationship to the empire.
But there is the danger of being co-opted, I guess. I mean, the state tries to recruit you for their service, and I know in the 60s a lot of student leaders, I went to Michigan, and a lot of the black protest movement people ended up working for the university, giving jobs and student services, whatever, as a way to kind of co-opt the protest.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, it'd be interesting to hear more about that and how the language of African-American particularity or of absolute ethnicity plays into the sorts of decisions that people make, the point where they say, well, actually, I can do more for myself and the people who are just like me by becoming, you know, I guess what I would think of as a disciplinary agent. And I, you know, I struggle with it. So after all, I mean, I'm teaching in an African-American studies department, and the people that I'm working with as a teacher are going out of there with PhDs in African-American studies and degrees in African-American studies. And, you know, I want to be in good faith when I do that, because I want to honor those traditions, and I want to celebrate them, and I want to develop a fund of oppositional knowledge which that history puts on the table. But I also follow C.L.R. James' dictum, which is that black studies was about the critique of Western civilization before it was about some sort of, you know, ethnic carnival.
Okay. Yeah, and we're speaking with Paul Gilroy on KUCI with Dan Sung and Glenn Mimura. I just wanted to shift to another topic slightly that I think is a new topic that you examine in Against Race, your most recent book, and that's really the emergence of the significance, I guess, of biotechnology and biomedical research. And in the book, I mean, you really place a premium on the power of these new scientific insights or discoveries into really, in some sense, corroding or antiquating our understanding of race. Could you say something about that?
Yes, in the context, my sense is, first of all, that they transform our understanding of what it means to be human by accentuating the fact that life is absolutely continuous across species and also absolutely mutable. This means that it's the same genes in your eyes that make your eyes work and function that govern the eyes in a fruit fly or something like that. You can remember a year or so ago when it was discovered that we had rather fewer genes than had been anticipated, the kind of great cry of disappointment which went up. So it seems to me that the biotech revolution changes our sense of what it means to be human and changes the stakes of engaging our humanism, and that we have to update our understanding of that out of some of the earlier specifications. And that has, I think, some striking consequences for the way in which we understand racial difference. And it may well be that, again, there are no guarantees, of course, but it may well be that this sort of 18th century definition of race, of where races differ from each other, is something that can't be maintained. It may well be that, with genomics, the sort of accelerating in the way that it is, there will be all sorts of new kinds of classifications and hierarchies that emerge in the world that relate. I mean, remember, I'm speaking about this from the vantage point of a place where there is a healthcare system which is provided by the government. Here, of course, where healthcare is just a business like any other, the consequences, the social and political consequences of this may be even more pronounced in terms of insurance and finance and all these other things, the emergence of a genomic underclass, in the medium term, may be something that has political consequences for which mere racial hierarchy is going to look very tame when compared to some of the sorts of evils that will be wrought in the name of genetic discrimination. So that's one aspect. And the other thing is, of course, actually the question of biocolonialism and the way in which colonial and imperial power in this moment of globalization fastens onto, privatizes, and expropriates the elements of life itself. It seemed to me that our practice and understanding of race politics in our world had to take that into account.
The patenting of DNA.
The patenting of DNA, a patenting of DNA drawn from the bodies of people worldwide, but also, of course, the patenting of genetic information in plants and animals from their own sort of environments, which become the private property multinational corporations.
One person who's spoken out against globalization is Ralph Nader, of course, but he's been criticized for not talking about race. I guess he is Lebanese, right? And the Green Party generally doesn't take much of a stand on racism.
No, and I think that's frustrating, really, because it's not possible to understand the patterns of colonial power and authority without, one think of, Lawrence Summers now, president of Harvard University, and that famous memo that he wrote about the relative value of life in different areas of the world and the sort of economic consequences of that. Obviously the Union Carbide disaster in Bhopal stands out in all our memories as a sort of living instance of what that kind of mentality produces in the world. I think that sometimes we can be, when we're doing the sorts of local things we need to do against race, and we're dealing with racial profiling or the prison industrial complex or the experience of undocumented and nominally illegal super exploited workers locally, we can somehow get so absorbed into that we lose the other picture. And I think that this area of the kind of the political ecology of race and colonial power is something that I really want to retain. There are ways of analyzing our predicament that allow us to connect these things together. And it's, of course, it's hard, and of course it's difficult. But I think that we are beneficiaries, in a sense, under the sign of globalization, of a fantastic opportunity, of a change of scale, which allows us, in a way that previous generations haven't always been able to do, to look at our world from the outside and see its connection. When I see the Buddhist monks, you know, in the Square of the Nativity, standing there in front of the Israeli military, you know, announcing the evil and immorality of their incursion, you know, I'm encouraged by that possibility. I'm encouraged by that assuming of responsibility, that sense of connection and identification which allows that gesture to stand.
We're on the radio, and you've experimented in a lot of media. You've narrated films, Isaac Julian's films, and do you plan to do more of that, multimedia kind of projects?
Well, yes, I do. You know, it's very frustrating, given that, you know, I've obviously had a working relationship off and on with Isaac Julian for something like 19 years now, since our first collaboration, Territories. I'm a bit frustrated by his turn to the art world, you know, so I would like him to do a bit more damage with the films and get back to that. So yes, I'm hoping that very much. I think that, you know, we are really much in a moment in this country in particular where functional illiteracy rates are climbing, where questions of illiteracy are really ought to be a primary object of political intervention for people like ourselves. You know, how do we get people to want to read? How do we restore some sort of, given that we now have the technology to manage and produce and circulate our own information, our own text, you know, we have to actually invest in a different kind of struggle to make literacy important again. But there are also whole new realms of communicative possibility opened up by the way the new technologies function. I think we have to engage those. You know, a lot of people in our communities are technophobic, you know, and they you know, they program the video or whatever, but they aren't always, or they play the video games, you know, but they don't necessarily always want to engage the world of technology that's underneath that in a more possessive way. It's not something that they feel they can take possession of. And I think there's a whole a really important layer of political education that has to be done there, and for me that's one of the highest priorities right now.
In terms of reading,
web pages for something
right.
else. You know.
But in terms of reading, do you find it hard to get students where you are at now to read foreign newspapers even? I saw you reading the London Times this morning, but you know, do you try to get them to read The Guardian? Do you try to get them to read other papers that are more critical of the system? I mean, how do you get students to read, first of all?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think I can't remember which old right-wing American sage said that war was God's way of teaching Americans geography. but and you know, we may, as a European, I have to say that it may well be a time that, you know, we'll look back on the moments where Americans were entirely indifferent to what was going on in the rest of the world with a kind of nostalgic pleasure. But obviously, right now, you know, there's an incredible hunger for information and the kind of manipulation and censorship and routine, you know, stultification of the American media is something which is almost unique. I mean, I think if your country is going to embrace its imperial power in a much more thoroughgoing way, then that kind of ignorance can't continue. So since September, it's been easier, I think, somewhat easier than it was in the past, to not only circulate information, but to actually open up the sources of that information. I mean, if you want to, you can sit there and read newspapers from all over the world online. I mean, that's the glamour of it. That's the lure. That's the pleasure and the power of it. It takes a lot of time to do, but it can be done. My question or my anxiety about that is whether or not that is enough, because I think you can drown in all that information, and sometimes it can make you inert. You know, you can over determine your experience, not just make you take away your hope, but actually you can have so much information that you can't act. So I think it's a way of actually struggling to find some kind of equilibrium there.
Well, are there what kind of alternative sources would you recommend?
Well, I mean, the independent media organization, Indie Media, of course, is fantastic. I like myself at the moment to read the Israeli papers every morning, even though I know that you know, there are problems. But there are many wonderful, important oppositional voices in Haaretz, for example. And to me, you know, it's incredibly important for us that we don't reinstate a binary there. This is not a question of Jew against Arab that we're dealing with there. There are many people in Israel who feel as critical or more critical than we do of the things that their government is doing, and we need to support them and connect with them and not allow for one second some sort of oversimplified binary sense of what's at stake in that conflict to kind of seep in, because if we do that, we'll be lost.
Yeah, I think Edward Said said the same thing about Middle East in terms of Arab countries, that there is a resistance movement, there's a, you know, to fight sexism, to try to democratize, mm-hmm. and the mainstream media, of course, ignores all that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously Al Jazeera, the TV station, has been a fantastic thing, and it's a really interesting example of not only the American government's incomprehension and desire to criminalize and to close down the free exchange and flow of information in the world, but of actually what appear to be, and my understanding of this is limited, but in a sense vernacular or distinctively culturally specific ways of organizing the flow of information, so that there are sort of formal disputes. And you know, if you do get to see Al Jazeera, you'll notice that the Israeli military, the Israeli government, and all these voices from the other side are very present and very visible there in a way that you wouldn't find on the terrestrial stations in Saudi Arabia or Morocco, whatever. And that's part of their understanding of what the politics information has to be. When the Taliban were destroying the statues in the Buddhist statues, they had a man from the Taliban who was responsible for that in the studio, and with him they had various imams from Egypt who said, look, we've lived with the pyramids and the Sphinx for all this time, we didn't destroy anything, what are you talking about, you know? And that for me is that, you know, there are all sorts of tactics and possibilities that are around in this, and the new technology allows us to really benefit from that.
And again, we're speaking with Paul Gilroy on KUCI. Actually, that's an interesting point. I mean, it's often touted as one of the kind of democratizing features of the new media is the increased access to communication and the ability to produce one's own information or whatever, you know, as long as you have the HTML skills and so forth. But at the same time, I think a key feature of your new book, again, Against Race, is a deep concern with the way in which corporate culture and its technologies have in fact been central to the articulation of what you see as fascism in the overdeveloped countries, at least today. And there's a kind of disconnect, I guess, in the way in which technology is being used at a corporate level and the way that it's being appropriated at a very hopeful but much less powerful and concerted level by individuals. Could you comment on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, info war is where we are now, and it's not an industrial kind of conflict any longer, and it's not, I mean, you know, of course, I'm not in any way wanting to minimize the sorts of commitments in terms of capital and so on that are involved in having access to that technology, you know, and I know that this is up and down, you know, largely an issue of poverty, but I think there are some other elements to it, and I think that because it means that the exchange and manipulation of information is no longer either capital or labor intensive, there is that possibility there. I know that in LA, in this area, there have been you know, some quite interesting initiatives in this part, at sort of community level, you know, drawing younger people who have that a sort of intuitive relationship with the technology towards a more active engagement with it, and using some of that, you know, I know in California here particularly there's been some connections between across sort of diasporic links and between different indigenous peoples in different parts of the planet around questions of land rights and things like that. So I'm very optimistic about that impact. But again, you know, let's remember that the technology on its own guarantees nothing. It's what we want to do with it, and you know, we need to in a sense feed our political imaginations, because nobody knows what this can do or where it can lead or what the kind of synchronized political solidarity or political engagement with one another in remote locations, what that really can mean for the future.
And in terms of this whole post 9/11 world and the increase in surveillance and technologies to kind of repress protest, do you feel that the British have learned a lot from their encounters with protests from Northern Ireland protesters and incorporated a whole new technology that they can actually they will share with the U.S. and stuff like that. Do you think?
Well, I think you know we mustn't be mesmerized by that. Of course, that is true, and you know, in Britain, if you, I don't know if anyone's been in London lately, but you'll notice the incredible proliferation of cameras everywhere, on every corner, and every, and you know, yes, that is a feature of urban life there. I mean, I think they say now if you walked across the central area of London from one side to the other, you'd be filmed by between 30 and 50 cameras, and any route that you took, you would have that experience. I mean, in this country, I think it's because of car dependency and because of the sort of the sprawl extent of the cities, it's very difficult to imagine an equivalent degree of surveillance. And of course here, you know, there are different legal issues that will be raised by that. I mean, in the college where I work, there was a struggle over the fact that the college where I work in London, there was a struggle over the fact that there was an arrangement struck with the municipality that the college would maintain and certain cameras would be on college property and so on. And this was, you know, considered to be a problem. But the first person, criminal, who was caught on the camera, because nobody knew what to do with the information because they weren't sure who was responsible for owning that information, and the second person who was caught was, you know, one of the security guards in the college who was sneaking off on work time to go and do shopping from a store down the street. So, you know, I mean, I think yes, you know, let's not be mesmerized by the Leviathan machine of the new technology. I think they can also be deluged with useless information. That seems to be one of the things that's happening. The same way that I was saying earlier on, we can drown, you know, by having too much information. They can also drown in that too. They're not always very good at filtering it.
And there's actually resistance to that. There's every year there's a day of no pictures or something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and people try to cover up the cameras or something.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. Certainly the anti-globalization actions in Europe, the camera's always the first target. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there's some aspects of this which are not really supposed to be talked about on the radio, but, you know, there are elaborate, you know, and quite simple tactics for maintaining one's privacy in those environments.
Okay, again, we're speaking with Paul Gilroy on KUCI. Follow up on another 9/11 question. In the wake of the attacks on the World Trade Towers and Pentagon and then the crash in Pennsylvania, there was a sense there was a hopeful sense, at least, among some left commentators, I guess, that after 9/11, there was a possibility of a kind of global connection of or a global movement towards solidarity and compassion between coming out of the sense of victimization that many people felt, you know, let's say in the wake of the World Trade Tower collapse, and movements around survivors of the disappeared in other parts of the world. Do you see that as something that's continuing to grow? Has that been realized, or do you see that as something that hasn't quite come to fruition?
No, I don't think it has come to fruition, although I will say that in terms of the anti-neoliberal movement on our planet, I don't think that those courageous people who chose to put their lives at risk by protecting the Palestinian population against the Israeli military incursion. And they're a rather interesting and diverse cosmopolitan collection of folks from all over the world, actually. I don't think that they would have been there without the sort of the resurgence of that struggle against globalization. I think there is a kind of continuity there. I think it's a fragile continuity. But I'm absolutely confident that kind of gesture, that kind of political practice will grow. And in the same way that I'm confident that the deployment of particular sort of national state regimes and the emergence of a planetary system of justice, which is supranational and exists, you know, above and beyond the grasp of any particular national order of justice, is something that will also grow and expand. You know, Ariel Sharon might duck or might respond to the danger of being placed on trial in Belgium as a war criminal by Harry having the primary a person who could testify against him in that court case killed in Lebanon. But I mean, at some point, some Ariel Sharon or some other figure, equivalent figure, is going to have to deal with those consequences too. So I think that at the level of a human rights struggle that is working through national states, there is one set of links. And then as a result of the success and the incredible energy of the movement against globalization, there are a whole new range of possibilities that open up. And I think that the indie media people who, you know, tricked their way past the soldiers into the Church of the Nativity and then started sending out information on their cell phones, which was challenging the image of what was going on in there that the Israeli spin machine had created. I mean, all of this is really, really very, very uplifting and very positive signs for the future. With regard to Americans, you know, making use of their experience of being wounded, of wanting to use the fact of their loss of invulnerability, you know, I think I'm perhaps more pessimistic about that. One of the, you know, right. I mean, one of the, you know, striking things in the last few weeks really has been that the fact that, I don't know if it's true in California, but certainly in the East Coast, the sort of romance between peoples of color and America is very much on right now. You know, there is a sense in which a readmission has been gained into the international community. And in a way, you know, I don't want to despise that, because I think if it lasts this time, you know, if it can be made to last, then obviously that's going to serve the interests of those peoples of color who are, you know, whose lives are very often, you know, life chances are very different. But the cost of that might well be opening up a larger gap between those people and other people outside of the overdeveloped world. You know, it may well be that African Americans don't want to identify with Africa very much in the future, except in its more sort of sentimental and archaic manifestations.
I understand you have some kind of anecdotes about the way this technology works, like fingerprinting.
Well, I mean, you know, I was talking the other night in my lecture about my experience of being processed for the acquisition of my resident alien status, you know, which allows me to work here and allows me to come and go more freely than I've been able to do up until now. And, you know, there are those classifications the government places upon you, and then there are the ones that you win for yourself or you choose for yourself, and they very seldom coincide, you know. I had some interesting experiences when I went to be registered and had my fingerprints taken, which involved me being, I ticked other when asked my race. I ticked unknown, which was a box that was offered me, but it wasn't acceptable to the people who were processing my application, who were very bewildered by the fact that I had, you know, I had ticked unknown when I really ought to have ticked black according to their rules.
But your son ticked something else?
Yeah, my son got misidentified as white, and he was very angry. He was more angry about that than I was about being, you know, obviously I understand why anybody would look at me and say that I was black, you know, but he found it very hard to understand why he'd been looked at and judged to be white. So in a way, you know, it's another hopeful sense that these classifications are always sort of more arbitrary and unstable than we like to imagine, you know.
So with the census, it was this 2000 census where they, you know, basically asked people to self-identify, and there are all sorts of categories that are possible. Mm. You think that? I mean, I know the.
Well, we don't know what they're going to do next, do we? We don't know how they're going to process those self-chosen categories back into a kind of racial scheme that fits with the particular policy agenda that they have prepared. And I think this is something that, again, that's been a feature of our political debates in England. You know, trying to work out the trade-off between the need to have that information in order to put pressure on government to provide the things it should be doing, and the need to challenge the way that those categories of subordination work. I mean, I don't think this is beyond us, really. And I think the shift towards self-designation is part of the answer. The question is how those self-chosen categories, I mean, get translated back into racial categories at the next stage in the coding of the data.
So that's hopeful, you think?
I think it's a first step. You know, as I say, I know that locally these things have a very particular resonance, legal significance too. And I don't know enough about the particular sort of local politics of that moment to be able to comment helpfully on it, I think.
Yeah, just to follow up a little bit on, I guess, what you refer to as translocal movements, sort of more hopeful possibilities of sort of local resistances or struggles or articulations of politics that are able to connect beyond just sort of their own limits, geographical or, you know, epistemological or whatnot. I mean, what other kinds of movements do you see emerging other than, let's say, something like indie media? Do you think there's, I think, within feminism, there's a big movement within sort of transnational feminisms to connect across various kinds of, of national and sort of transnational spaces. And RAWA, you know, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, had kind of had its 15 minutes of fame, right? Right after the attacks on 9/11, they were, and you know, they maintained, I think, quite a very powerful critical voice. But one of the ironic turns is that in recent months they haven't been, at least in their own estimation, backstabbed by big government so much. They've simply been neglected. But that they've really been backstabbed by the feminist majority in the United States, which just recently bought out Ms. Magazine and apparently had published an article inaugurating this new ownership by talking about how feminism had saved, you know, implicitly white Western feminism had saved the women of Afghanistan. And RAWA on their website now has a letter, you know, quite viciously protesting and very carefully sort of outlining the problems in their omission from this history, not so much about self-congratulation, but about saying it's about writing out certain kinds of histories. Can you comment on that?
Well, you know, I think feminism, like many of the oppositional movements of modernity, is in an incredible crisis right now, and I'm not sure what the political forms of a global feminism are going to be. I don't think anybody knows that yet. We know what some elements of the kind of cultural forms of that global feminism might entail, but we don't really know what its political forms are going to be. And I think, you know, it's obviously, looking at this particular episode to which you refer, you know, it's very tempting to say that that we're dealing really with the kind of completion of a sort of enlightenment, you know, civic project of the Enlightenment, completion of the bourgeois revolution, you know, and that's one perfectly valid and important element in the unfolding of a feminist politics. I want that to be completed. I want it to be substantive, but I don't believe that that's all that there is to feminism. And I think that how can we put it? We might distinguish between the forms of a feminist politics which are to do with the quality of life, and the forms of a feminist politics which are to do with life itself, and the idea of a political culture which arises in a situation where people don't know whether they're going to be alive tomorrow or not. They don't know whether they're going to have life tomorrow. They don't know whether they're going to have water tomorrow. So, you know, I think there are forms of feminism which speak to the experience of people who are dealing not with the quality of life but with the continuity of life. But I don't think that those the relationship between quality of life feminism and, you know, this other sort of biopolitical feminism is really been resolved. I think the conversation between RAWA and the editors of Ms. Magazine, you know, is an instance of working out that relationship. And I think that there are, you know, there are many other struggles worldwide that we could identify as being part of that. You know, some of them have already come up in this conversation, the question of the position and predicament of women under certain forms of Islamic law, charged with or sentenced with crimes which although they are locally resonant and maybe bound up with the rights individual and collective of a particular populations, are things that are unacceptable within the terms of any sort of feminist politics. Being stoned for adultery or whatever is not going to be acceptable. When you've been raped, you know, it's not going to be an acceptable element to feminists anywhere in the world. So I think these things are being worked out, and I think I'm encouraged by the fact that there is a politics involved in listening to what other women in other places actually have to say. I mean, obviously the immediate verdict on what happened in Afghanistan would be to say that they're being ignored because they served their purpose to the American military adventure.
You know, it seems that always U.S. groups seem to think that they can just export their brand of ism to another country without taking into account local conditions. and assuming that everybody there's a feminist there is like a feminist here, the identity of a feminist is the same.
Well, I think that's true. I don't think that's just a problem of feminism. You know, I think everybody right. suffers from that. I mean, when I was in South Africa last summer, it was very exciting. I was very happy to be there, having resisted going there for so long. I'm very unsure about what to expect. One of the first things I do was run into African Americans there who were saying, "Oh, this is just like America." And I had to say, "Well, you know, I'm not sure you're right, because I think black people are majority in this country." And then that means we have to like rethink the terms in which our articulation of a politics and multiculture is going to be cast, you know, because the white people are 13% here, and you, of course, are 13% in the United States.
Well, thank you very much, Glenn Memora and Paul Gilroy, for joining us in this provocative conversation. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show were not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California nor the management of KUCI. Thanks for listening.